Welcome to TFP, the Theater Folk Podcast, the place to be for drama teachers, drama students, and theater educators everywhere. I'm Lindsay Price, resident playwright for Theater Folk. Hello. I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. All right, this is episode 172, and you can find any links to this episode in the show notes, which are at theaterfolk.com/episode172. Today, we are talking language, specifically foreign languages. Well, foreign to me, anyway. They're not foreign to the people who live in the countries that we visited, but they are not my home language. And we're talking about seeing theater. So we've got language, foreign language, theater. Okay, who's put it all together? Who's tying all the knots in a bow? Ah, you guys are so smart. Yes. So we are talking about seeing theater in another language. Have you ever done that? Have you ever went to a show where you knew you wouldn't be able to understand the dialogue? It's a pretty fascinating experience, actually. It's something that you could replicate a little bit, show your students YouTube clips of bits, of movie bits from another language and see what they comprehend. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. So my theater folk partner in crime, Craig Mason, we did just that. We, whenever we travel, we make it a point that to go see some theater. And so when we were in Iceland and Norway, we saw plays in Icelandic and Norwegian, some with some very clear communicative stories telling, and well, some not. You'll have to listen to figure those ones out. And that's our purpose here in this podcast, is to talk about what these experiences were like, not just as pieces of theater or plays, but pieces of communication. How do these plays communicate physically and visually? How much of a story did we understand when we didn't have the language? And how much does acting, relationships, and verbal technique come into the equation? It's a whole big critical thinking mosaic. That's a good word. Everybody's got to put their critical thinking cap on. And I'm going to say critical thinking one more time, because then we've really got some 21st century skills going on. We've got some communication. We've got some critical thinking. Oh, it's all good. And then there's one bonus section about a piece we saw in Scotland that had no dialogue, just scrap metal and music and lights. So how did this particular piece communicate? Well, that's something else you're going to have to listen to find out. I can't give it all away in the intro, can I? Okay, so let's get to it.
Hi, Craig.
Hi, Lindsay Price. Hey, you didn't call me by my last name.
I didn't.
I called you Lindsay Price. You called me just Craig.
Okay, well, let's start again.
Okay.
Hi, Craig Mason.
Hi, Lindsay.
Oh, snap. Actually, what you've just done is a very interesting play on the place of where we are right now. Where are we sitting?
We are sitting in Iceland.
Iceland, Reykjavik, Iceland. And a fun fact is that in Iceland, they don't really use last names. Everyone is on first name basis. Like, even the prime minister is on a first name basis, because everybody is John's son or John's daughter. So, fun fact. Okay. We're actually here to talk about a theatrical experience that we had last night. And that was Mamma Mia. Now, you may ask, why on earth, Craig Mason, would we go and see Mamma Mia? And there's a couple good reasons. What's one good reason?
Well, one is practical. We're only in Iceland for 3 days, and we want to make sure that we see some theater in every country we go to.
Yep.
And this is pretty much the only show that we could have seen.
Yeah, May's not a great month for seeing theater, and it was really, really a bit sad, because the particular theater we went to, the Reykjavik City Theater, which has a name which we will put in, which we will not even begin to try and say, put in the show notes. And they had some amazing looking pieces in March and February and April, and then Mamma Mia was in May. However, here's what really sold me on the show, and that is that it was not Mamma Mia in English. It was Mamma Mia in Icelandic.
And not only is the show in Icelandic, and I've seen this before where a show's been translated into a language, but the songs are maintained in their original language. No. All the lyrics were in Icelandic too. So there was absolutely no English whatsoever in the entire show.
So our goal then becomes, when we go and see a show like that, is how much do we understand? Now, the story, I know I am a long time listener, first time
admitter.
I know ABBA songs. I know them all. So that wasn't an issue for me. And the story is pretty simple. It's a girl's about to get married and she doesn't know who her dad is, and narrows it down to three people from her mom's diary and invites them all, and then
it's almost like a Shakespearean intrigue kind of plot.
Hilarity ensues. Yes. But that's all we knew. Like, I hadn't read anything.
And never seen the show before, in English or any language.
But so let's talk about, what was your preconceived notion of Mamma Mia before you saw it?
Well, my understanding of Mamma Mia is that it's a big, campy kind of disco fest of a show with a thin plot. And really just an excuse to string a bunch of ABBA songs together. That was my, let me be clear, that was my expectation going in.
Yes, exactly. These were our preconceived notions, considering we had never seen the show. We only knew that it was ABBA, and you only know from what you see. And of course, when they show you the clips, like on, if you're seeing it on TV or somewhere, it's the finale where they're all in the 70s getup and everybody's posing and making mocking faces. And that was my preconceived notion, was that it was a mock and that it was...
Or it was camp.
It was camp, and it was a little bit cynical and not something you would engage with. So, spoiler alert, holy cow, were we wrong? I've never been... And we didn't understand a word of what they were saying. But it was 3 hours long, and I was captivated from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
It was engaging,
mm-hmm.
and we had a really great time.
It was one of those rare experiences, too, where everybody on stage was completely full of life from beginning to end, whether they were in the scene or not. There was lots of, you know, background action going on during scenes, and no matter where you look, no matter who you focused on, there were vignettes, there were stories being told. It was wonderfully directed and beautifully acted, I thought.
Well, I think, and I want to just clarify that, stories being shown, not stories being told.
Sure.
Yeah, but that's important for us because we don't understand what people are saying, but
yes,
we understood really well what people were doing.
Yes.
And that, I think, is this is a director, somebody needs, and also this company was, obviously they've worked together a lot. I don't know how much work there is here in Reykjavik for actors. I don't know if these guys have day jobs, or, you know, maybe they work together as a team and so they're able to support themselves, but it was so clearly a communicative cast, and they were visualizing everything.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was like that improv game where you can only do a scene, but you do the scene, but only speaking in complete gibberish. And I've also seen it done actually as an acting exercise, like when you're in the middle of a rehearsal, do this scene, but don't use the words, use gibberish. And it was a lot like that for me, except it was completely like that for me. It was gibberish to me, the language. But what was wonderful about it was how effectively they were able to communicate the story, the relationships, their emotions. The text was almost unnecessary.
I have a I took some adjudication class with an instructor by the name of Ron Cameron Lewis, who has a long history of adjudication in Canada and in the States, actually. He's pretty well-known guy in that regard. He taught at Theatre Sheridan for also a long time before he retired. And he taught me a percentage that I use all the time. I say this all the time in every adjudication I go to, I think. Also, anytime I talk to students about directing and visuals, and that is, audience understands 60% of what they're seeing, of theatrical experience visually, 30% orally, 10% text. And this was such a perfect example of that formula, because we understood by the characters and their relationships and the blocking And then it was, after that, it was the tone of voice. You know, when someone is saying in a language you don't understand, and they give a, you know, they give a sidelines glance, and they like swoosh their bum up against, you know, like they sit a little closer to the person next to them. You don't need to know what they're saying to know how they're feeling. And I think that was really clear. The young woman who played the daughter.
Sophie.
That was the one word we saw it heard a lot. Also, the word nay, which is no. They said that a lot. In her exuberance and her sincere portrayal of the role, she was like nervous and excited and confused, and she played that with her body. Like, she physicalized this character in a way that you didn't. It was okay. Sure, we missed all the verbal jokes. Apparently, there's like lots of body puns in the script, and so we missed all those. So what? It's a really interesting experience that I didn't expect about how much visuals and also sincerity plays in seeing a piece.
Okay, so what are the takeaways here? I think my takeaway is how valuable that exercise is, actually, that gibberish exercise. And I think it's something that, you know, if you're rehearsing a show right now, I think it's important. Take any scene in the show and tell the actors, especially a scene that they're struggling in physically, and take the actors and tell them that they are not allowed to use any of the words in the script. They can only speak in gibberish or Martian or any invented language, so no English whatsoever. And bring in someone who is unfamiliar with the play that you're doing and have them watch the scene. And have them, after watching the scene, communicate to the actors what they thought the story of the scene was. And you know what? They'll be very surprised.
Mm-hmm. And just in terms of, it will just get the students out of their heads and into their bodies, and how we communicate so much with body language on a daily basis. And it's always amazing to me how difficult students find to physicalize their character or physicalize their relationships on stage. Fantastic. So gleeful. I just loved it.
Well, it's so wonderful to go in expecting something, you know, silly and camp, and to be actually moved, like I would hope to be at any night in the theater. One other thing. Well, actually, you know, I'm not even going to mention the set. Do you want to mention the set?
The set was... Oh, we can mention the set because it's part of a visual. And the set was so awesome. It was fun to play on, very efficient and effectively used.
Mm-hmm. The set was on a revolve, and so they would use the revolve. When one transitions from scene to scene, the revolve turns, but not only did the revolve just turn to reveal a new scene, the scene would transition across the movement of the revolve. So so people would be walking in the opposite direction of the revolve and going up and down levels of the set. So it was like cinematic. It was like we were sitting watching a movie, and we were watching a tracking shot where they lay rails down on the ground and the camera runs on rails sideways. It was like that, this panoramic cinematic transitions between scenes. It was visually stunning, the show.
And yet very theatrical. Mm-hmm. And it was a great way to bring in the ensemble and have them do scenes, you know, in the very dark background. Everyone was engaged. Everyone looked like they were having the time of their life, which is exactly what you want with the show.
First class stuff.
First class stuff. Okay, that's it for us.
Mamma Mia, we'll see you in Norway.
Bye.
Okay, so our second play that we went to in another language was a bit of a punt for us, wasn't it, Craig? We didn't plan to see this play.
No, we were out and about. There was a show that we wanted to see, and we couldn't get tickets online, and we just dropped by the theater, and we couldn't get into that show, but the nice box office lady said, but there's another show you can see at 8 o'clock. And she gave us she said, it's all in Norwegian, though. So do you speak Norwegian? And I said, no, but I speak theater. And then we walked away for a bit and thought about it. And
we went to the front and we tried to look it up online.
Right.
So this is also, we should say, we were in Reykjavik before. Now we're in Bergen,
Norway.
And we went and looked at the pictures, and the pictures looked really visually interesting.
Yes. So we were like, okay, this is it. We'll go. 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 And then so, and the greatest thing about the night was that the lady took pity on us and gave us half price tickets because we didn't speak Norwegian. So she figured we were only going to get half of the show. So it was very nice.
We went away and we went to the nice pub across the street. And again, thanks to the mighty Google, we were able to look it up because the playwright was not a Norwegian name. It was Jennifer Haley. And we're like, well, okay, what is this? And we found that it actually an American playwright, Jennifer Haley, and it is a play called The Nether. So it was an adaptation, a Norwegian adaptation of this play. And when we looked at the visuals of the play online, it looked pretty stunning. No, we didn't look at the visuals till after.
Right.
We read the description.
We read some reviews.
That was it.
And we had some idea of what was going on.
And three things came up that made us think that we were going to get something out of this play as a non-Norwegian speaker was that it was about the future. And it was about the internet, and it was about a virtual reality world.
Yes, it was. It's a detective thriller set in the future inside the internet.
Mm-hmm. And it poses actually a interesting, it's not quite the right word, a question in that if somebody is doing something really wrong in the virtual world, in this case, it was pedophilia. If they're doing it virtually, is that bad? Is mm-hmm. that wrong?
Is that the same as committing the crime in real life?
Mm-hmm. And the main character, the cop in this case, felt that yes. And so she was pursuing the guy who owned this particular world. And then we also went inside of the world. So we didn't know what was going on. We had a little bit of an idea. But we thought, I bet we're going to get something out of this.
Mm-hmm.
That was what we said going in. So we went to this play. It was 90 minutes long. Would you say that was a long 90 minutes, Craig?
It felt like, you know, if I ever get cancer and I'm told that I have a 1 week to live.
You would go see that show.
I would just go see that show over and over again because then it would feel like I lived for decades.
And let's be clear. This is a show that gets amazing reviews in it's been performed numerous times in the States and in London, and it had a ton of really great reviews. So here's our question.
Okay, go ahead.
So here's our question that we're dealing with here. That is this a play or is this production? And there were a lot of production problems with this show that we saw.
That's what I felt too. I'm sure you can tell that we actually really didn't follow the show at all. I didn't read the part before we saw the play that the detective was a female, and I had no idea that the female character was the detective. That's how little clue I was shown visually. As to who the characters were.
Well, and there was no set. Like they were, there was
no. Was, there was no set.
There was no set. There was nothing for them to sit on. They wandered or they stood, and it's like, well, a talking head in Norwegian is just as boring as a talking head in English. Like mm-hmm. It was just literally characters standing on stage. They didn't touch each other. They didn't look at each other. And I'm sure this was all intentional, but it just left no visual clues.
Mm-hmm.
There was a huge screen. That they projected nothing onto. It's like, what is this? I mean, they did, but
abstract thing.
Yes.
Abstract computer-looking things. There were the three of the main characters. I'll put it this way. Three of the main characters were a cop, a Svengali-like webmaster, and a pedophile. And I don't know if I was ever 100% sure which person was who. As a matter of fact, the cop, it was the two men that I was thinking were the cop, and I was trying to figure out which one was the cop. And as it turned out, because I figured the person wearing the white lab coat must have been the internet person. And of course, that was the cop. So there was nothing visual, nothing in the staging that gave me any clue. You know, I'll contrast this to Mamma Mia. Now, granted, Mamma Mia is a big, bold musical, and you know, there's a lot more clues in a musical, I think, as to who's who. However, they, you know, even things like costuming, Even things like the way characters are positioned on stage to show status. There was none of that. None of that was achieved in this show. And at the end of our Mamma Mia conversation, I talked about how great an exercise it would be to do a scene that you're struggling with the physicality, do it in gibberish, and have someone watch it and see if they can tell what's going on. And this was a beautiful example of how necessary that is.
Visuals are. Mm-hmm. How necessary. I think status is a really interesting point because we didn't learn. So, of course, we went home afterwards and we like looked it up. And if you look up the Nether, and if I remember, I will put some links in the show notes. The other productions had gorgeous visuals that looked like they were in the future. And one thing we didn't realize until afterwards and we looked up more, it was that the whole thing was based on an interrogation.
Yeah, there was no sense of the interrogation in this show. The interrogation was two people standing side by side.
Yes, not looking at each other. And at one point, I'm like, well, one guy, maybe he's her boss. And then the other guy, the relationships were so ambiguous and so vague. And I'm not saying that this needed to be like, because we're obviously not the audience for this play. Mm-hmm. We just happened to be there and just happened to go see it. But theater is a visual medium. And I think that first of all, how boring it must be to only talk. Like, you know, and not...
Yeah,
and
I think it was basically like a books on tape. There really wasn't any more added by sitting in the theater watching it than you would get listening to a book on tape.
And obviously this was all choices, because I know also too that the virtual world was supposed to be this beautiful 19th century Victorian garden, because the world, the real world, this show presents, is completely bleak and barren, you know, so these people are going into this world and they have this beautiful screen to help project the world, and instead they, like, plastic flowers, like, kind of came down from the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. I will say this, though, as we can wrap up this, right? Because there's not much more to say. I will say this, and this was actually true, this was true in Bergen, Norway, and this was true in Reykjavik, Iceland. The diversity of the audience is very impressive here. A marked difference than an audience one would see in North America. North America, it tends to be a much older audience. Here, the under was, we were among the oldest people in the place. There were families. There were teenagers, like, alone, not dragged there, not forced there by anyone, but that was their night out together.
It was Friday night.
Yeah, it was a Friday night. It was date night, and there were teenagers in the theater watching a drama about pedophilia. So that's how important I think theater is here, or that's how highly regarded it is here.
I gotta say, I'm really, and even though we didn't, you know, enjoy the show, I am enjoying this experience of seeing, you know, what we could get out of a play, of theatrical experience that we don't orally understand. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, and this is something that, and I'll end on this note, it's so important to inject a physicality into your storytelling. And how we are a visual world now, and that it's kind of, I think that it's an important thing. It's an important thing to pass on to your students. All right.
That's the Nether.
That's the Nether.
We'll see you in a couple of days for Richard III in Norwegian.
Whoop.
Okay.
This is Richard the II plus first.
Plus first. So,
so it's Richard the
third. Craig, this is our third non-English play that we're going to talk about.
But the first one named after Richard.
And I think this is a lovely full circle we've come here. So we started with a musical, and then we moved to a modern play, and now we've gone back, we've gone into Shakespeare.
Yes.
And this is Shakespeare, not English Shakespeare, but Shakespeare that's been translated into Norwegian. So we saw Richard III in Norwegian.
Yes, so we had to familiarize ourselves with the story a little bit, so we had some idea of what was happening and what to look for.
But it was really interesting. This is a nice one to end this sort of podcast on, because what we're going to talk about with seeing Richard III, and we saw it at the National Theatre of Norway, is theatricality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, theatricality is a wonderful communicator.
Absolutely, and I think they were very effective in this production with the use of staging and the dynamics between the characters to really help tell the story. This is a stark contrast to the show we saw the other night.
So this is a modern version of Richard III that we saw when the play started. The play starts with Richard III. The first line is, "Now is the winter of our discontent,
made glorious summer by this son of York." So it begins with the end of a war.
Yes.
So everyone is at last at peace and relaxed. And the way they affected that in this is that when they opened the house, it was like there was a disco going on. Yeah, it was like the lights were going, the music was going, and all of the
actors. Champagne was flowing.
Mm-hmm. And all the actors were on stage, just basically at a, I guess.
At a party,
yeah.
It was very interesting to see Richard, who is had his hump and had one of his arms wrapped up with duct tape, sort of off on his own, not really, sort of participating, but not really participating.
No, he was skulking on the outskirts, and then we were sitting in the front row of the second balcony, and at one point in the pre-show, he looked up and made eye contact with us, which I thought was cool, and he raised his glass and took a drink, and we raised our imaginary glasses and took an imaginary drink.
And then the set itself was just basically steps. So it was like 7 or 8 huge steps.
Yeah, like 4-foot steps
that people had to crawl and leap from and dive over. And
yes, and I took a picture of the set before the show, at intermission, and at the end of the show, and we'll make sure to add those photos to the show notes because they really do help tell the story of what we saw here.
The visual, just the whole visual of it in a theatrical storytelling. And also, and the last thing I'll say about just setting up our little discussion here is that it was a minimal casting they did. There was a lot of the actors doubled their roles.
Mm-hmm. And there was no distinction as to men playing women, women playing men. It was just whoever was available at the time.
Yes, and this is a conversation for another time, but I really didn't like that Margaret went to the character of Margaret.
The one great female role.
Well, not the one great, but a great female role in this part was played by a guy. But this is not a gender discussion. This is a discussion on
what we saw.
What we saw in terms of getting a sense of a play only by its visuals. And these visuals were completely theatrical. They played with blood in so many ways, because Richard III is a really bloody play. Like, mm-hmm. Richard basically kills everybody in his way to get to king.
Mm-hmm.
And then he keeps killing people so that he can remain king. And they had buckets of blood. Clarence was killed by, it was played by a woman, and she rolled down various steps, and blood was splattered.
Well, the murderers kept picking up various buckets and throwing the blood at him. And so when you look at the photos in the show notes, the one from intermission, you see these large swaths of blood going all the way down the steps. That's from that particular murder.
So, that's a great example of how do we show a modern death of this great Shakespeare moment. Well, I'm going to take a bucket of red paint and I'm going to throw it on an actor.
At a white set.
We don't need to have understood the dialogue leading up to that point to know exactly what's happening.
Yes.
And they played with blood in lots of ways. They had squeeze bottles, like ketchup and mustard squeeze bottles, that were filled with what I hope was tasty blood substitute, because whenever somebody got their throat slit,
mm-hmm.
the person who was slitting the throat took a huge pull from the squeeze bottle, mime slitting the throat, and then
spat out
the fake blood.
Yes, and the play ends with like a mighty bloody battle, and the way they affected that was they had one of those big what do you call those things?
Paint sprayer?
Yeah, it would be like a paint sprayer or something you would use if you were doing chemical fertilizing on your lawn.
That's
like
right.
Liquid fertilizing on your lawn. It's like a big jug with a hose attached to it. So the big jug was filled with blood, and then the hose was just being sprayed everywhere on the white stage. And you'll see that in the ending picture. You'll see this blood everywhere, and that's where that came from.
And it was really interesting, too, because this play starts with a celebration and that it's peacetime. And Richard basically says that because he's ugly and he's deformed, that he's made for war and not for peace. So he's basically going to ruin the country.
Ruin the party. He's the ultimate party pooper, this guy.
He is the ultimate party pooper. And it's interesting. And I can only assume it was intentional because it was... Some part of me thought it was really effective and some part of me thought it was really annoying. But there were streamers out all over the stage. So everybody, as the blood piled up on the stage, and everyone tramped these streamers basically to the mud and the dust and made noise. And it must have been really annoying for the actors to always have these streamers at their feet. But when you think about it in a visual way, in a theatrical storytelling way, what better visual of the party's over than these streamers just dusty and bloody and crumpled to death?
I was worried people were going to trip on it, but I think they were quite used to it.
I think, it's been open since February, this particular production. Another really neat thing they did visually was that anytime anybody died, they got their name. They basically made their own tombstone, mm-hmm. and they put their name again on the white set with a cross beside it. So again, just showing the deaths piling up that Richard is accumulating. Again, another great visual. I don't need to know the story.
Yes.
Too.
I think the most effective point of that was when there's two young children who he has murdered in the show. I think it was most effective when they made their own tombstones. Just these two little children writing their names, and there was nothing else happening on stage, and it took them a while to write their names.
Yes,
and
it was
quite touching.
They weren't very good. It was a little bit of a struggle.
Yeah,
because they were tiny. They were like 5 and 6, maybe. Yeah. And they basically wrote their own tombstones. Like that. What a more theatrical moment than that. I want to end this by talking a little bit with you, Craig, about the Richard Ann moment.
Yes.
There's a scene at the very beginning of the play. So Richard kills the king previous to the king who is now, and his widow basically walks across the stage and is followed by two guys carrying a beer with a bier with her dead husband on it. Mm-hmm. So she's got she's leading her dead husband to his tomb, and knows who killed him. And Richard needs to marry her to help them
along in his ascent to power. Yeah.
And it is not a very long scene, but it's a scene that goes from I hate your guts, I hate your guts, I hate your guts, I will accept your ring and I will marry you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a fascinating scene. It must be very challenging for anybody who has to do it. So here we are watching this scene that, yes, we know what's happening, but no, we don't have the dialogue on the tips of our fingers, or tips of our ears. And what was your impression just sort of seeing the theatricality of this scene, not being able to understand it?
I thought it was quite beautifully staged. I mean, she came in too. Did you notice she came in with a fogger?
Yes.
She entered the scene with a fogger, and she walked across one step and then down and then across the next step and down. So she ended up creating this whole kind of wall of smoke on the stage.
That magically dissipated when Richard started talking to her.
Yes.
I'm sure it wasn't magic. But.
I don't think it was magic. It was just the smoke went away.
Oh, I think it's magic.
No, and I think I thought that scene was quite striking. I mean, what did you think?
Well, I think it was a really interesting on the theatricality of power, because Anne was played by a man.
Yes.
And was played by men in drag, and he did not in any way try to affect of being a woman. He kind of played like a man. And he had the power in the whole scene. It was directed so that Richard was beneath her almost the whole way.
Either yes.
He was on his knees, or he was chasing her, or she was the one with the power for the whole scene. So to see him wrench the power away and actually from a place of weakness and to actually win the scene was a stunning visual. And end this on another interesting visual, which didn't quite work, but I think it could have worked, was that later on in the play, our last time we see Anne, right before she gets, Richard kills her, she's pregnant.
Yes.
And that is another it's another devastating blow when you know that she's dead and Richard killed a pregnant woman.
And towards the end of the Richard and scene, they threw dirt over the corpse, right?
Yes.
Do you remember who threw the dirt first?
No.
Oh, okay. I don't remember either.
I didn't think that Anne threw the dirt. I thought it was just Richard.
Richard. He kept tossing dirt on top of it. Yeah.
Tossing dirt.
Yeah.
Oh, that was another way they used the blood. Like when Anne was talking about, you know, basically that Richard is a murderer and he's a horrible human. He took a squeeze bottle and he just went to town.
Covered the dude.
Dead Henry and just covered the dude in blood. You know, what this all comes down to, as we sort of put a pin on this, is how much you can tell a story through your visuals, through your theatricality.
I think so, too. And I think it's important to come up with your concept and your interpretation for the show and go for it and make sure that that concept is carried through for the entire show. I felt like they both of the shows we saw in Norway, Underland, whatever that was, and this one, we had a lot of not great things to say about Underland, but both of these shows had high concepts that they carried through all the way, and I think sometimes to their detriment, like where you try and wrench your concept too much into it, but they committed to what they were doing, and I think that was, in both productions, I thought that was very well executed.
Yeah, this is the question to ask when you were directing the show. What is your visual? What is your visual image? Mm-hmm. What is your image for your vision?
And this one was clearly a party. A party gets ended.
Yes.
Yes, in a big way.
And
I think that was their thesis
way.
For the show, and I think that's what they did. And I thought it was a wonderful, wonderful production.
Yeah, I'm
so glad I saw it.
Yeah.
We saw a trailer for it that was kind of. Looks kind of zany, and we almost went to it as the show as a goof, just to see some wacky European interpretation of Shakespeare. And I came away quite charmed and quite moved by the piece.
I thought it was great. I thought Richard was great. Actually, his cohort, whose name is escaping me, not Breakbridge, Bambridge, Buckingham. He was fantastic. And there is a moment when.
He incited the audience to start cheering for Richard.
Here's another moment of theatricality. Yeah. He has to incite the English public they have to be the ones to say that Richard should be king. Richard can't say, I'm going to be king. He has to have public backing. And the way that it's written in the play, it's actually not that easy. Buckingham goes out and tries to get, I think that's his name, he goes out and tries to get it and actually comes back to Richard with, they didn't say anything, they didn't want you. And he has to go back again. And the way that they do it in this production is like a tele-evangelist revival meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets the audience involved. Again, theatricality. We knew exactly what was happening, even though we didn't exactly know the words.
And everyone in the audience was shouting for him to be king by the end. It was really exciting.
Yeah, we were all part of the play.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Okay.
Love it.
We'll see what's next.
Okay, so we're going to wrap things up with this podcast on something that was an experience, but something a little bit different. Where are we, Craig?
We are in Glasgow, Scotland.
Glasgow. So, of course, we're not seeing a play in another language in Glasgow, although we could have...
you very well could see a play in a different... We did go to a... Are we talking about the play reading? No. But
no.
We went to a play reading, and a lot of it... felt like it was in a different language. They have very distinct ways of pronouncing words and using words here. I was actually quite surprised at how different
the communication is.
Scottish is from English.
Wow. And also, well, the Scottish, not the Scottish, because there's also the Scottish language. There's Gaelic, which is a language that looks like you should be able to pronounce it, but it's absolutely impossible to pronounce.
Mm-hmm. It's Icelandic and Norwegian is like that too.
Yes, very much so. So what we did is we saw this, it was a very fascinating piece of literature on this show. It was called Sharmanka Kinetic Theater. And what it is it's this guy who grew up in communist Russia, had a menial job. He lived in basically a closet. And for some reason in his 20s, started carving sculptures. And then he attached, again for some reason,
like discarded machines, yes. Like sewing machine parts, and then small engines.
Yes, and then he would connect motors to them to make the sculptures move.
Mm-hmm.
So, long story short, he's been in Scotland for 20 years, and he has this little theater of moving
sculptures,
machine sculptures. So you go into this little room, and you sit in front of an array of sculptures.
Mm-hmm. And we have a few photos that we'll put in the show notes of the podcast too,
And we'll do the website as well. And then the array of mechanical sculptures tell a story. There's no dialogue. There's some music, which has some influence, but basically you're just looking at the movement of sculptures and the communication of movement and symbolism of movement tell a story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so what was your response?
Well, my first response was, is this theater? If there's no performers on stage, am I actually watching a piece of theater? And if I'm not watching theater, what exactly am I watching? But then as I was watching the show, you felt so connected. We didn't get to meet the artist,
mm-mm.
But I felt so connected to the artist, and everything looked so handmade and crafted. And when it moved, I felt like I was watching a puppet show. Even mm-hmm. though the artist wasn't there, I felt like I was watching something that a person, an artist had put together. And for that reason, I certainly decided, you know what, this is theater. It's just in a different form.
I thought it was theater because the communication that was being presented to me was, it was symbolism. It wasn't spoken word, but there was a communication happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think because there was a communication happening that I too thought it was theater. Now we saw three pieces, and I think there's some limitations to this communication. It all kind of started to feel the same. But the first time, you know, when you see somebody who is moving a wheel, and it's that repetitive motion of moving a wheel, and then a second person is moving a wheel, and a third person is moving a wheel, and there's just this bell that goes off, and it's just this everyone moving in this repetitive movement. You know, you don't need to be a genius to know that something is being communicated to you, and it's mm-hmm. monotonous, and it's not there's no light or life to it.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got a machine, which is a large sword that's being swacked against a piece of metal over and over again,
yeah.
And there's some red light and some heads on sticks, you don't need to be a genius to figure out the symbolism.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I appreciated too was that I was expecting a more linear storytelling, but it really was more like tone pieces, like
yeah.
mood pieces, and you kind of assembled your own story in your mind, I think, as you were watching it. And then
yeah.
they give you a little guide, but we didn't read the guide, or I didn't read the guide until after I had seen the pieces. So sometimes I was seeing what the artist had written about, and sometimes I saw something different. And you know, I mean, with art, that's fine, I think, to see different things. I mean, I think that's a good sign of good art when different people can see something in different lights.
Well, and we'll wrap this up by just going off on a little bit of a tangent, because another thing that we've been doing on this big trip has been seeing modern art. And we've been really frustrated with the modern art that we've seen, because it seemed to get and make an opinion on it. It seemed very dependent on having to read the
1,000-word essay on the wall.
The 1,000-word essay that came with it. And is that art if you have to read an essay to have an emotional reaction? I think that's a great question to sort of put out there.
So if you're ever in Glasgow, I highly recommend coming to see Sharmanka. It's a very curious piece of theater. We cannot possibly do it justice just talking about it on a podcast. The best we can really do is to link up to their website. I think there's a little bit of video on their website, and we also took some photos of the pieces to have a look at. Really curious stuff, and if you're a theater maker, I think you'd be quite inspired by looking at this and actually thinking about how you can adapt this into physical theater, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, how would you there should be some video on their site, I think. And how would one take the machine movement and adapt that into your own pieces?
Mm-hmm. Or how do you take symbolism and use symbolism as your storytelling? Mm-hmm. How do you use a symbol as a method of communication?
Mm-hmm.
Craig Mason, this has been really interesting. We've had a long journey with all of this.
Yes.
We saw many things in many different languages, and the last language was no language at all.
And the last language was no language at all. Perfect. Excellent. Thank you so much.
Aye.
Before we go, let's do some theater folk news. All right. So, now that you've done your critical thinking for the day. Check that off the list. But where else can you find materials to get your students thinking in that 21st century skills mode, right? Get them going in the critical thinking, creative thinking, communication, collaboration. Where could you go to get lesson plans, units, resources, professional development courses for you? Yes, just you, that cover these skills and more. And more than that, cover them for your students. Well, you should become a member of the Drama Teacher Academy. The DTA is a membership site that is part of the education arm of Theater Folk. And I'm telling you, we have got your classroom covered with all of those things. Units, lesson plans, resources, professional development courses. You can check it out at dramateacheracademy.com, all one word. That's dramateacheracademy.com. You can also find the link in the show notes, which is theaterfolk.com, episode 172. Go check it out. Finally, where can you find this podcast? We post new episodes every second Tuesday at theaterfolk.com and on our Facebook page and Twitter. You can find us on youtube.com/theaterfolk and on the Stitcher app. You can subscribe to TFP on iTunes. All you have to do is search for the word Theater Folk. And that's where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care.